Howdy, everybody, and thanks again for joining us here on Expanded Perspectives. That's right, we're here at it again today. I'm Cam Hale, as always. Chilling with me in studio is mi amigo, Mr. Filio Filson. Kyle, my brother, how are you doing today?
I'm doing excellent. I'm very excited about being here in Skeleton Studios. I had an interesting weekend, and I'm glad to be back in studio, about to get into these crazy, yes, unusual stories. What's up with you, man?
Man, nothing. I am really looking forward. I don't know. The weather's nice. I'm looking forward to this week. We're ready to get to it. Been doing a lot of reading. Kind of got a fire rekindled in me again. I'm really looking forward to the grind. Folks, for those of you that follow us on Instagram, or maybe even Mr. Logan Huffman on Instagram, you saw what we were up to. Saturday, Kyle and I went and met Logan. He's shooting a movie in Dallas. Kyle and I slid over there to Dallas and grabbed Logan, went and had some barbecue.
Yeah.
Ran around town over there, and then we went down there to Dealey Plaza and showed him all the stuff over there by the Kennedy assassination, all that. Had a wonderful time, man, hanging out. We've spoke to Logan a few times, but got to spend all day hanging out, and he is a wonderful human being, man. I really love that guy. He's great.
Yeah, it was pretty fun, right? Getting to talk with him and stuff. He has a vast knowledge of the paranormal.
He does.
Who knew,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, right. You never know who's really into it, and that's, you know, what they enjoy to read, and that's what's fun about it. I love when you bump into people that you least expect or something like that, you know, and that's what was great. There's another thing too, folks. Before we get started, we just want to, you know, take our hats off, say we're sorry for everything that went down there in Florida. Man, that is a horrible, horrible thing.
Yeah. Right?
It is a terrible bummer, and I'm not going to get into the whole deal. Lieutenant Governor here in Texas is a real a-hole, and that's pretty much as far as I'm going to go with that. I'm not a fan of that guy. I'm just, look, I don't care anything of what goes on, as long as what you do doesn't affect anyone else. And when that happens, and you just, he's negative, and you know how we are about negativity, folks. We don't appreciate that at all. But I tell you what we do appreciate, and I think you're going to. Get a load of this, homies. Reptile-like humanoid encounter took place in Homewood, Alabama back in 2012.
Who doesn't like a good story about reptilians?
Well, after we talked about the chupacabra and some of the reptilian stuff, the way it went down and all that stuff on the Elite show, I saw this. I just got to talk about this. This is what it says. Fella says, while in my home one day working out, I'd been going through some things spiritually. So I did a lot of research on various things. So I would work out and then meditate. And then for the record, I'm a firm believer in God. But while taking a break, I sat down and looked at the TV. And then for some reason, I had a notion in my mind to look up to my left. Why? I don't know. But I saw a silhouette that had a weird shape and looked like a deformed bubble. But not actually a bubble, I felt a presence. So I watched it for a while, and then looked away just the same way I had looked up at it. I felt the presence. Whatever it was, it wouldn't move. I couldn't figure out. It just sat there. So okay, I brushed that off. Then I was awakened out of my sleep one night on my stomach with my head being pulled back with a weird force and noise. Now what's crazy is I just brushed that off. Now I'm scared, but I'm like, okay. But I continue researching and meditating, basically praying anyway. Then I'm laying in my bed one night, can't sleep, but I want to. I was awake, and suddenly I had a sighting which felt different, more personal, because for that moment, nothing else existed. I don't know what to call it, but I saw a human reptile with red eyes. Resembled an athletic man's body, but a reptile. And it didn't speak. I felt the tension between us. I looked at it as if it wanted me. And I don't know for what or for why, but I knew at that moment that that's what it wanted. Well, I wasn't going to let it have me, so I stared him down. And he backed down and turned and walked away. Or should I just say, went away. And that's where they leave the story. Now, how wild is that? So felt several presences at the time, and then actually finally saw it. So, Philly, I ask you that because, look, this person says that they were meditating.
Yeah.
Like we always talk about, you get in a different mindset, things like that. Did you open the door to let this thing in? Was this thing already there? Is it something that you're, I don't know.
This fellow must have been awfully intimidating, though, to stare down a reptilian and then decide to back off.
Just stink eye. Like, what you got? What you got?
Right. I don't know.
It's crazy.
It's an interesting.
It's a very, I'll tell you this. I'd be wanting to sell my house if I was in something like that. I wouldn't want no part of that.
Well, speaking of houses for sale, did you see this from Long Island, New York, Cam? If you would like to own a piece of paranormal history and you're not afraid to live in a house that's linked to a horrible murder, then you're in luck because there's a house that's back on the market. That's right, Cam. The home that inspired the Amityville Horror book and movies is once again for sale on Long Island, New York.
You're kidding.
No, I'm not. The house, they say, was last sold in 2010. And in 1974, of course, it was the scene of a gruesome murder. Now, if you're not familiar with the story or you've never seen the movie, the Amityville Horror, back in 1974, Ronald DeFeo killed his entire family. He killed both his parents, his brothers, and his sisters, all while they slept in the early morning of November 13th. He shot them while they were in their beds, and all of them within 15 minutes. Just before that, he began showering and he got dressed for work, and on his way, he dumped the bloody clothing and the gun in a nearby storm drain. Now, when he got to his family's car dealership, he called home, pretending to find out why his father didn't show up for work, and at noon, he left his job and spent the day with friends. Well, around 6 p.m. that night, he called a friend saying that someone broke into the family home and killed everyone. Now, DeFeo eventually confessed to the murders, telling police, "Once I started, I just couldn't stop. It all went by so fast." And of course, he was eventually put on trial in October 1975. He was found guilty on 6 counts of second-degree murder. And on November 21st, 1974, he was sentenced to 6 consecutive life sentences, and he remains in jail to this day. Now, the first family who lived in the home after the murders were the Lutz family, and they said that they encountered poltergeists in the home, and that's basically what the movie's about. He said they only lived there for 28 days in 1975. His mother of the Lutz family saw glowing red eyes. His stepfather was awakened by strange noises at the time the murders happened, and the family's daughter had a strange imaginary friend. They also had outlandish claims of strange smells, drafts, and objects moving on their own, and a priest who actually visited the house said he heard someone telling him to get out.
And they want to try to sell this? No, right. Thanks.
So if a murder scene, you know, or any paranormal happenings don't faze you, this house could be yours. But of course, there's a catch. They say you must have proof of funds before you can even get an appointment with a real estate agent to see the house. But if you're into that kind of thing, and I'm sure there are, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
There's people that are into the macabre. They're into the scary. They like to brag that I live in a house where a massive murder happened.
Imagine what you could turn that into, like a museum-wise or something like
Well,
that.
Well, right. It also,
an
right.
attraction.
If a rich person decides that they want to do some paranormal investigating, maybe they purchase the house just to conduct studies. So if you're interested, I'm in real estate. This house features 5 bedrooms, 4 bathrooms, a boathouse, a boat slip, a 2-car garage, and is listed at a cool $850,000. American.
And a partridge in a pear tree. So, it's got all that.
Hey, man, it's for sale. I personally would never live in a house where I knew something like that happened.
Yeah,
but I do remember the old movie. And I know they made a remake with Ryan Reynolds. I wasn't as big of a fan as I liked the original back in 1979 with James Brolin. You remember that?
Yes, I do.
And maybe the reason I liked it better is because I was a child when I saw it. And, you know, what's funny is the house that they used in the movie, the 1979 movie, that house actually was in my grandmother's neighborhood in Tom's River. And not the house where it happened, the house they used to film
the movie.
Right, yeah. So I remember that as a kind of like just a couple blocks away. Everybody would go, "Oh, look, that's where the Amityville Horror was filmed." I'm always going,
"Don't stop. Keep driving." Yeah, exactly. Cool. I think what's funny, too, about those older movies, now that you bring it up, I was thinking about it, is it leaves more to my imagination. I don't like a lot of the, like we've talked about, I don't like a lot of the CGI, things like that. I think it's better for your imagination because that's scarier, whatever you imagine, than what somebody else can show you.
We were just talking with Logan just the other day about it. I never really thought about it. We were talking about how the older movies seemed better. And he brought up the point that, well, yeah, the older movies were all, you know, written by playwrights and people that worked in theater.
Yeah.
And that's why they were better stories.
They had to captivate the audience.
Right. Where nowadays we rely on CGI and stuff. Mm-hmm. How many times have you gone to the movie like you were talking with me about? You went and saw the Transformers.
Oh, well, it was back when it first came out. And I waited for it to come out. But yeah, the Marky Mark Transformers.
And you watched
horrible.
That. And I watched, what was it, Mad Max, the new Mad Max.
Told you not to do that.
Right? There's a lot of CGI. There's a lot of action. But the plot is horrible.
Yeah.
You're halfway into it and you're like, what is that? I don't even, what's going on? Who wrote this?
It's a joke.
And I also think that's why they're constantly doing remakes, right?
Yeah.
Like the new Ghostbusters that's coming out.
No thanks.
The original Ghostbusters was awesome. I remember being a kid. I remember watching that and loving it. In fact, I think for Halloween, I even dressed up as one of the Ghostbusters.
Nice.
But, you know, I've seen the previews for this new one. And it's not because it's all women. It's nothing like that. It's just that, I don't know, it's not the same. Bill Murray, Dan Aykroyd, you can't recreate that.
Egon's gone, man.
Why couldn't you come up with a similar story and not be Ghostbusters? Why couldn't you just have another paranormal story about women hunting ghosts? I don't know. I just hate the remakes. It gets old.
It does. I give it that. Kyle, we always talk about ancient history, and I always like, and it's something I always wanted to get a poster of, and I've never done it, but Angkor Wat. And when I bring up Angkor Wat, it's in Cambodia. Yeah.
Very interesting.
It's a beautiful place.
It doesn't look like any other megalithic structure on Earth, right? And it's intricate, right?
Yes, very.
It looks like you could spend hours and hours just looking. I don't know, man. I like the architecture of like Thailand and Cambodia and Laos and stuff like that. It's really neat.
Well, for people, like I said, look up Angkor Wat. It's beautiful. It's actually a very large site. It's actually the largest religious monument in the world. It covers now, for everybody else, it covers 162 hectares. For us Americans, it's 402 acres is what it actually covers. But the reason I bring that up is because if you look it up, you start gazing at all around Angkor Wat, you look how thick the jungle is, and it's beautiful right in there where it's at. But it's very thick, heavy jungles in those areas. The reason I bring that up, too, is because archaeologists in Cambodia now, this comes from The Guardian, have found multiple previously undocumented medieval cities not far from the temple of city of Angkor Wat.
Imagine that.
Right? Now, there's an Australian archaeologist named Dr. Damon Evans, and his findings will be published in the Journal of Archaeology Science today, on Monday, and will announce that cutting-edge airborne laser scanning technology has revealed multiple cities between 900 and 1,400 years old beneath the forest floor down there, the tropical forest coverage. They say that there's some which will rival the size of Cambodia's capital city. So that's insane to me. Now, there's been some experts. They believe that they've recently analyzed this data. And this all went, they started capturing all this flyby. They were flying over it in 2015. They covered 734 square miles of that area. And they said it shows this. Colossal, densely populated cities would have constituted the greatest empire on Earth at the time of its peak in the 12th century. So Evans himself says, we have entire cities discovered beneath the forest that no one knew were there. It turns out we've uncovered only part of what they call, and I'm not even going to pronounce this. All you folks get a kick out of this. Everybody that can speak Cambodian, good on you. I'm not even pronouncing it. We're just going to say it starts with an M and it ends with an A, and it's got about 35 other letters in between. That's how we're going to go.
Right?
Yeah, but how crazy. And look, it goes deeper, folks. We could dive in here deep. I can go through all this. But it basically, what they're saying is they found these new cities. What they did is they were firing lasers on the ground from a helicopter to produce a very detailed image of the Earth's surface, kind of like a sonar done with a laser. Now, Evan said that the airborne laser scanners have also identified large numbers of mysterious geometric patterns formed from earthen embankments, which they believe could have been massive gardens also.
Yeah, well, they found Stone City.
Yes.
You remember Stone City, right? In the movie Kickboxer, that's right. How he was training.
Yeah. Yeah.
You had to go to Stone City and you train with the old ones. And that's how you learn to defeat Tong Po. You remember
that's
that?
Right. Yeah, I forgot about that.
Yeah, that's,
you're right.
That's what they found. I can't remember his master's name.
But yeah, that's basically, that's what you're talking about, is they found that up in the brush, up in all this stuff. I am blown away by it because it's, yet again, it's one of those things too, like we always talk about in the Amazon and stuff, is what's all out there. Well, this is the first steps before now. If this works out and they start uncovering that, well then how long before you start having drones that can fire those lasers cheaper than you can have, and you can pre-program a drone to fly a certain pattern, and then you launch 30 or 40 of those drones, and it maps out, laser maps out the entire undergrowth under that forest canopy that's hidden in the Amazon or in the Congo, and then now you're like, okay, now we have the coordinates. We can fly helicopters. We can go directly to it instead of traipsing down through the malaria zones to try to find all this stuff. This is just scratching the surface of what I think in the next 20 to 30 years, we're going to see people finding more and more of these great civilizations that we never knew existed. And so basically,
that's my favorite part.
Yeah. Well, like we said before, you're just going to have to take history books and pretty much set them aside and leave the last, just leave a lot of blank pages at the very back, because it's just going to start changing stuff now. Now we have the technology to find what was hidden. So this is what's coming.
Right. That is very cool. Have you seen this? This is neat. This is something we talk about from time to time on the show about going to the moon. Why haven't we gone back? Why has no one else been there? I saw this recently and it caught my eye. They're talking about how a private company wants U.S. clearance to fly to the moon. They say plans by private companies to land spacecraft on the moon or launch them out of Earth's orbit face legal obstacles because the United States has not put into place regulations to govern space activities. So anyone other than NASA, SpaceX, Virgin Galactic, or the military, you have to go and seek permission from the U.S. to even do it. So if me and you built a ship, like, what's that, the Farmer Astronaut?
Mm-hmm.
Astronaut Farmer with Tommy Lee Jones, remember that?
Yeah.
If me and you were to build something, we couldn't just fly to the moon. We have to get permission. And I remember even in that show, that movie, it's like a Disney movie, he was trying to get permission from the FAA and stuff, and he wasn't able to get it, but he went anyways. A man named George Neild, who's the head of the Federal Aviation Administration's Office of Commercial Space Transportation, recently said, "We do not have formal authority today to deal with what happens on orbit or on other planetary terrestrial bodies. That's the issue that we're wrestling with right now. What's being looked at is a Band-Aid fix because the system is broken." Now, according to an international treaty back in 1967, the United States and other signatories began to authorize and supervise space activities by its non-government entities. But they say no U.S. agency since has the authority to regulate commercial airspace activities outside of rocket launches, spacecraft re-entries into the atmosphere, and operations of telecommunications and remote sensing satellites outside of Earth's orbit. So basically, I guess you can go into lower Earth orbit without, you don't need any permission to do that. I guess that's how these cell phone companies and things like that are getting their satellites.
I got you.
But if you want to leave Earth's orbit and just go to the moon, you can't just do that, which I don't understand. You have to have permission. That's kind of odd to me. I guess we view the moon as ours because we're supposedly the only people that's had a man on there. Is that why? They don't really get into that. But what I find interesting is that there's this new company out of Florida called Moon Express, and these are the people that are asking permission from the U.S. government to land a spacecraft on the moon in 2017. So we're talking really, really quickly. Now, I got to looking into this Moon Express. They have their own website. I'll put links to it in the show notes. It's very interesting. Their motto is, "We are blazing a trail to the moon to unlock its mysteries and resources for the benefit of life on Earth and for our future in space." They talk about, "We believe it's critical for humanity to become a multi-world species and that our sister world, the moon, is actually an eighth continent, holding vast resources that can help us enrich and secure our future. The moon is unique in that its surface has remained relatively constant over billions of years." Listen to this clip.
"We will be sending robotic landers initially to the surface of the moon, carrying scientific and commercial payloads. Then we'll get into the era of exploring for resources and learning how to process those resources and bringing them back to Earth."
"The moon, unlike Earth, has not been molten for 4 billion years. Okay, so the things that hit have stayed on the surface. And it doesn't have that atmosphere to burn things up. I think there's more platinum on the moon than there is in all the mining reserves of planet Earth."
"The platinum, the rare earth elements. Plus, you have helium-3 that essentially you can use for fusion energy. In a small amount of helium-3 could provide energy for the whole planet for hundreds of years. So it is not just a fun project. It is also a great business."
So that's what they're doing. It's going to be unmanned. They're going to fly this thing up there, and they're going to use this device. And they're planning on, Cam, they said they talk about massive amounts of platinum, massive amounts of helium-3, and all kinds of other rare minerals. And the thing that they're going to use is called the MX-1 Lunar Lander. Now, they revealed this thing back in 2013, and it's about the size of a large coffee table. It's completely self-contained. It's a single-stage spacecraft that can reach the surface of the moon from a geosynchronous transfer orbit, they say is commonly used to place communication satellites above the Earth. It's also designed to be a flexible spacecraft platform that can support a number of applications, including serving as a flexible, agile upper stage for existing launch systems, enabling Earth orbit CubeSat development. Remember that CubeSat we saw?
Mm-hmm.
Satellite servicing and space tug applications, which is used in cleaning up space debris. This thing's that it's powered. Its rocket fuel is basically hydrogen peroxide, and they say that it's covered in like solar panels, so it gets the energy from the sun. It's totally autonomous, and it's pretty interesting. So they're trying to get permission to go there as early as next year. So won't that be interesting if this actually goes through? Because how many times do we say this on the show? Could there be something up there that nobody wants us to know about?
I think so, yes. I think there's something up there. I think we're going to find something, surely.
So what do you think is going to happen with these private companies now that are developing these robots and rovers and stuff to go up there? They don't want them to share this information. Do you think that somehow the MX-1, while it's launching, is going to have some uneventful mishap?
Well, it makes me think, too, like all the people that are the flat earth believers and things like that, that always say that none of people have said we've never been to space and things. If we've never been, why are so many companies still striving to get there if we really can't go? Is this all part of the facade? All these people spending their money and all their time to get to space? Is this all just part of the facade to make us believe that it's able to go there or not? It seems an awful lot of work to keep up some cover if you just let it die.
Elon Musk and SpaceX and Virgin Galactic and these other private space companies, I mean, they've been up in space already. Don't you think they would say something?
Well,
they're in on it. Yeah. Come on.
Well, see, that's what I'm getting at is I'm like, you know, it would be easier just to not bring it up. I mean, what's the best way to let something die? If you and your wife are fighting, what's the best way to keep bringing it up and trying to rehash it every 2 or 3 weeks or every few months or just to never bring it up again? Just never bring it up again.
Right. I agree.
But that's not what's happening.
Yeah. So very interesting.
Yes.
I'm looking forward to this. I think it's cool. I'd like to see what's up there on the moon. But I don't think, you know, they're talking about for the benefit of mankind. I think if this company goes up to the moon and they do discover massive amounts of platinum, then that's it. That's the new gold rush. All of a sudden, you'll see all kinds of companies coming and going up to the moon to try to get, you know, like a gold rush. That's what it's going to be. Mm-hmm. I like the way they describe the moon as the eighth continent. It is kind of like a continent.
Yes, it is.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, it really is.
That is pretty interesting. Well, let's take a break, folks. And when we get back from the break, we're going to get into some phantom train sightings. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives. People commonly think of ghosts and apparitions manifesting in only human form. But it seems there is also a global phenomenon of ghostly transportation. People have seen ghostly horse riders, horse-drawn carriages, ghost ships, road vehicles, ghost aircraft, and trains have all been reported all across the world. One place that's no stranger to this phenomenon is the United Kingdom. For some reason, the United Kingdom has a long history with the phantom trains. Starting off in the southwest of England, the sounds of a phantom locomotive are said to echo along the tracks in a tunnel at Box, Wiltshire, near Woodchester Mansion. The last appearance of this phantom train was in 2001. Although no train was seen, a film crew who spent a night at the building heard thunderous, disembodied banging sounds, which came to a head as the unmistakable sound of a steam train that plowed straight through the old house. The London area also has a few ghost trains. In 1980, a diesel-powered engine called Nimbus was cut up for scrap metal. However, it has been spotted several times since, running along the tracks at the South Tunnel of Hadley Wood Station. A stretch of the Northern Line, which is part of the famous London Underground, is reputed to be haunted by a spectral steam engine between East Finchley Station and Wellington Sidings. During the Second World War, building work commenced on Highgate High Level Station, but the station was never completed. Nevertheless, locals occasionally report hearing a steam train in the area where the track was supposed to have been laid. Lincolnshire is home to a couple of ghostly trains. In the 1920s, a rail crash occurred at Ancombe Bridge near Elsham during foggy weather. 4 people lost their lives in the accident, and ever since, a ghostly train appears at the accident spot, but only during foggy conditions. The train is said to emit a soft glow. At Hallington, near to where the old station stood, many witnesses have reported hearing the sound of an old steam locomotive passing during the night, even though the track was closed in 1956. At Halsall, in Lancashire, a man decided to shoot some video footage at a nature reserve. As he stood on a disused railway bridge filming, he heard the unmistakable sounds of railway carriages speeding along the disused tracks below. But when he looked down, he saw nothing. One story takes place in Scotland, which seems to have several stories all its own. Part of the old Highland line lies at Dunfail in Moray. The line fell into disuse many years ago, and the track itself was ripped up and removed. However, a ghostly train is said to haunt the route where the tracks once lay. Although the train's interior lights are always blazing, no one is seen inside. It also has been seen passing the site where a nearby station once stood. Other witnesses report being blown backwards by a large rush of air, as if a train had just shot past them at a very high rate of speed. Late one night in 1997, a Mr. and Mrs. Madison drove south along a lonely old road. Suddenly, they heard the whistling and chuffing of a steam locomotive close to the old station at Balquhidder Junction. In the distance, north of their position, they spotted a line of moving lights which looked remarkably like carriages. Shocked, they related their experience to Mr. Madison's father, and to their amazement, he told them that the line was permanently closed by a landslide back in 1965. The most commonly claimed ghost train sightings in Scotland are alleged to take place on the Tay Rail Bridge near Dundee. At around 7:15 p.m. on December 28, 1873, the central spans of the recently constructed Tay Bridge collapsed as a passenger train went across it. The bridge and train plunged into the icy Firth and Tay River below as a force 11 gale howled all around. None of the 75 people aboard survived, and only 60 bodies were ever recovered. Although the recovered carriages were damaged beyond repair, the engine was later salvaged and used again on the line for a few more years. Most of the girders salvaged from the collapsed bridge were incorporated into a replacement bridge right alongside its remnants. Many witnesses have since reported seeing a brightly lit phantom train speeding along the Tay Bridge on the anniversary of the disaster. The ghostly train is said to disappear in the center of the bridge, as if plunging into the icy waters once more. But the United Kingdom isn't alone in sightings. There are other countries, like Russia, France, Germany, even America, where these phantom trains are seen. Pittsfield, Massachusetts, is home to a ghost train, which has been seen only twice, and both times in 1958. One of the more unusual ghost trains that has been seen is this one, the one in Pittsfield, Massachusetts. In February 1958, a man named John Quirk, who was the owner of the Bridge Lunch Diner at the corner of North and Eagle Street in Pittsfield, was astonished one day during the lunch service when he and several of his patrons watched an old-fashioned steam locomotive barreling down the tracks at a very high rate of speed. The train was heading eastbound, and although it was traveling at a very high rate of speed, Quirk recalled that he could see every detail of the train, right down to the pile of coal in the tender. He stated that the engine was pulling a baggage car and a half dozen coaches. John instantly knew that something wasn't right. He had owned and worked at this diner for several years before the sighting, and he had watched a dozen or so trains go by every single day. So he was more than familiar with what an average train looked like at the time. That's one of the reasons this train stood out. Quirk reported the speeding train to some local railroad officials, and they looked at him like he was crazy. One of the men and John were friends, so giving the friend the benefit of the doubt, he decided he would look into it some more. Well, after a thorough search, he came back to his friend John, told him that what he saw was impossible. There simply were no records indicating an eastbound train to be passing through Pittsfield at that time. And what was more perplexing is the fact that steam engines hadn't been operated on that line for several years. About a month later, the speeding locomotive came rocketing past the diner again. It looked the same, arrived at the same time of day as the last sighting, and once again was barreling down the tracks, headed eastbound. Several patrons and employees saw the train as well. Steven Strauss and Tim Kautsonikoulos saw it and backed up John's outlandish claims. Now, this was not necessarily a good thing for Mr. John Quirk. Many people in the town began to mock him and say that he was losing his mind or simply making up a good story in order to attract business at his diner. But John and several other people all claimed to be bearing witness to the same thing: a steam-powered locomotive pulling five or six coach cars, moving at a high rate of speed eastbound. None of them ever changed their stories. So what was this ghost train witnessed by John and the small group of people? In a 2006 article about the Pittsfield ghost train, Joe Derwin points to an accident in late August of 1893 when an express passenger train headed from Chicago to Boston wrecked near Chester, approximately 30 miles east of Pittsfield. 13 were killed in this wreck. So is this the cause of the phantom train? No one knows. Newspaper articles from late August and early September of 1893 state that the train crashed approximately 1.5 miles below Chester while crossing a weak iron bridge. Two sleeper cars, a buffet car, and a diner car fell into the river below. Now, local maps of the area indicate that this most likely would have been the crossing over the Westfield River, nearly 30 miles away from the diner in Pittsfield. One thing I have to remind you, the ghost train only appeared to people inside the diner. But why? According to newspaper articles, such as the one that appeared in the September 2nd, 1893 edition of the Roanoke Times, the bridge was in the process of being upgraded to support the weight of heavy locomotives, but the work crew had gone to dinner before finishing their work. The train crashed while the workers were eating. The train's passengers were also eating dinner when the bridge collapsed. Newspaper reports state that the survivors were those in the two coach cars, while the victims were those who were in the two buffet or dining cars, for a total of 4 cars that went into the river. Interestingly, the report of the accident, which appeared in the Ohio Democrat, stated that the train was running 7 minutes behind schedule and probably was speeding in order to make up lost time. On September 8th, the Vermont Phoenix reported that the construction workers were to blame for the disaster. At a hearing held in Boston, the foreman of the bridge company testified that the rivets had been taken out of the bridge's upper cord and were not replaced with drifting pins, and this allowed the bridge to collapse beneath the weight of the locomotive. The crew apparently was going to finish the job after returning from dinner, since the nearest town with a restaurant would probably have been Pittsfield. Perhaps that's the reason why the Phantom Train only appeared to those inside the bridge lunch was because it was the site of a restaurant where the lazy bridge workers had gone for dinner. And maybe the ghost train was intended to be a ghastly reminder of their negligence. I'm inclined to believe that the ghost train, if it existed at all, was indeed the Chicago Limited Express bound for Boston. The train was speeding eastward, as diner owner John Quirk reported in 1958. Newspaper reports indicated that four cars plus the engine fell into the river, while two coach cars and a smoker car remained on the tracks. That makes a total of seven cars plus the engine. All who witnessed the ghost train described a speeding steam locomotive pulling a half dozen coach cars and a baggage car for a total of seven cars plus the engine. Another interesting Phantom Train sighting is the one of the Boston Bridge. In the early morning darkness of August 27, 1891, a steam train derailed off Boston Bridge into Third Creek, just 2 miles west of Statesville, North Carolina, where many were killed. Now, some 125 years later, it is said that every year the Phantom Train repeats its final journey, playing out the crash again and again. At approximately 2:30 a.m., the Richmond and Danville Engine 9 left Statesville after taking on a load of passengers and goods. The train was running behind, and so was in a hurry, as the boarding took longer than expected, and the engineer attempted to make up the time along the way. Less than 5 minutes later, and traveling at 40 miles per hour, the steam engine launched off the north side of the Boston five-span bridge and plummeted to the ground 60 feet below. The engine, tender, baggage and a second-class car, a sleeper, a first-class and a private carriage all crashed into the bushes, rocks, and stream. Estimates say that the sleeper carriage landed 150 feet from where it left the track. Cars ended up on top of each other, crushing those in the carriages below. First class ended up crushing second class, and the private car crushed the public sleeper car. Much of the iron from the tracks was taken with the train, piercing carriages and adding to the already tragic scene. Several survivors made their way on foot to the closest town in order to tell of the crash and to grab hands for the rescue efforts. It took the rest of the night and well into the next day for searchers to locate all the survivors and, of course, all of the dead. Convicts were brought in to help with the search cleanup. It was not until the scene was completely cleared that the full horror of the event could be told. Many of the victims, who did not die in the crash itself, died as they slowly drowned in the waters of the creek below. A Miss Llewellyn Poole told how she held her mother's head clear of the water until her strength faded and was unable to bear the burden any longer. She had to sit there and watch as her body gave up, allowing her mother to drown right before her eyes. The engineer was pinned under the engine's cabin where he died. Next to him were two of the female passengers who had been thrown clear of the first-class carriage all the way to where the locomotive lay. The injured were taken back to Statesville, but as there was no hospital, they were put up and cared for in private homes. The dead were taken to a tobacco warehouse where families and friends could view the bodies of those unidentified. It didn't take long for onlookers to come to the site to have a look at the tragedy for themselves. The coroner came to the conclusion the wreck was caused by the removal of railway spikes, causing the track to become loose. It took 6 years to find the culprits, and two men were convicted after making confessions, while they sat in jail for an unrelated crime. Altogether, 23 people lost their lives in this wreck, and many more were injured, both minor and crippling. The Bostian Bridge train wreck would have essentially faded into obscurity if it were not for the events that took place on the location years after the tragedy. Exactly 1 year following the wreck, some people were walking near the bridge when they heard an almost almighty crash and a distinct sound of twisting metal. They immediately made their way over to the sound when they were met by a man in a railway uniform who asked them for the time, even as he stood staring at his own pocket watch. The group ignored him and ran onto the bridge to look below, seeing by moonlight that nothing was there. They turned back to the man, who was now gone. It is believed that the group had run into the elderly baggage master, Hugh Linster. Now, Linster had just been presented with a gold pocket watch for his 30 years of service to the company on the night that the crash happened. In another bizarre sighting, 50 years to the day after the crash, a woman was waiting in her stranded car near the bridge when she was startled by seeing a train come rushing past as if out of nowhere. She could hear the chuffing and see the steam, and then all of a sudden, she heard a tremendous roar of a sound as she watched it derail and crash into the creek below. The noise was tremendous. She frantically made her way to the side of the drop and looked down at the scene below. She could see the wrecked carriages and hear the moans and screams of the trapped and injured. Soon, a car pulled up alongside hers, and she ran to meet the person who got out. It was her husband and the local store owner who had come to help her fix her tire. She yelled and screamed at them to come and help the victims of this crash. But when they arrived, nothing was there. No train, no dead, no injured passengers. She was the first person to actually witness the phantom train of Bostian Bridge. People have since claimed to witness this strange event, or at least pieces of it, either the sounds of the train passing or the sound of it derailing and crashing into the ground below. It has become a yearly pilgrimage for ghost hunters and thrill seekers alike. There was even a man killed in 2010 while looking for this ghostly train. The 29-year-old was on the bridge with some friends hoping to get a glimpse of the phantom train when a real train showed up instead. The engineer blew the whistle and tried to slow the train down as much as he could, but it was too late. All but two of the group made it to safety. The man from Charlotte pushed a woman off the side of the bridge to safety. Now she fell 30 or 40 feet and suffered some injuries, but he was struck by the train and killed. Still, some people venture to the site, and no doubt, this August 27th, just like every other, another group will venture onto the bridge and press their luck as they attempt to witness the phantom train for themselves. Which leaves us with perhaps the most popular phantom train in the United States, the Lincoln Ghost Train. Abraham Lincoln was the first U.S. president to be assassinated. It was decided by Lincoln's family and the powers that be to bury the murdered commander-in-chief in his adopted hometown of Springfield, Illinois, rather than in the nation's capital. The result was a massively orchestrated funeral procession by train throughout much of northern United States. On the anniversary of Lincoln's death, it's said that a phantom funeral train is sometimes seen running the route originally taken by the dead president's locomotive. Clocks and watches in towns along the way are said to stop cold as the train passes by. Well, as it turns out, one of our listeners claims to have seen this spectral train one evening. And he says, "I'd been transferred to the Hudson Division of the New York Central System and was working the rails on the main line between New York City and Albany. I was on the late shift to start with, since I was a bit of a night owl. And after 6 weeks of stomping the tracks and mending the rails, I was feeling right at home in my new job. Then, just before midnight, on a clear spring night in late April, we got a report of some brush on the track near our station. So, I was sent out to immediately clear it away before the next train came. I had nearly an hour before the next train, and so I didn't hurry as I walked along the rails. It was surprisingly pleasant and rather warm. Overhead, the clouds were obscuring the moon, but the light from my lantern made a cheerful glow in the night. Suddenly, a chilly wind swept over the rails with a whoosh, like a wind just before a thunderstorm. It was so strong that it nearly knocked me over. I staggered backwards, swearing and windmilling my arms to try to keep my balance. I almost dropped the lantern, but I managed to get my balance just before it slipped out of my hand. Shivering because of the sudden cold, I squinted down the track and I saw what looked like a huge blanket of utter darkness rolling towards me. It blanked out the rails, the trees, the sky, everything. "Good Lord, what is that?" I gasped. I leapt away from the track and started to run back towards the station, but the darkness swept up and over me before I had moved even a yard. The lantern in my hand was snuffed out instantly. I stopped, unable to see more than a few paces around me, and to my right, the rails began to gleam with a strange blue light. I staggered backwards from the tracks, my pulses pounding in fear and dread. What was going on? Then, a headlight of a train pierced the thick darkness. It gleamed blue-white in a strange black fog. And when it appeared, the rails brightened in response. A huge steam engine, draped in black cloth, approached, stacks bellowing from a steady stream of smoke. The brass on the engine gleamed, and it pulled several flat cars along behind it. I stared into the windows of the engine, but I couldn't see any crew. Just at the edge of hearing came the faint sound of music, and it turned to look at the flat cars behind the engine. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. I started backing up while just staring ahead and bumped into a nearby tree growing near the tracks. I just watched in disbelief. I know this sounds crazy, but I swear, I think I saw what looked like a couple of semi-translucent, Civil War-dressed men saluting the train as it passed by. And that's when I knew what I was seeing. This was the funeral train of Abraham Lincoln. I had heard about these stories from co-workers and friends in the past, but I thought of it as merely some kind of urban legend. Well, as it turns out, it's real. I've actually spoken to a few other guys who've seen it too. The steam train moved slowly away, and with it went the darkness, and the chill, and the clouds that had been obscuring the moon. In my hand, the lantern sprang back to life. I blinked a few times and brushed away a tear. As the world around me brightened, I saw the reported brush littering the tracks right in front of me. Mechanically, I cleared it away and made sure the track was safe for the next train. Then I went back to the station. The next morning, all the clocks on the Hudson Division were 6 minutes behind, and all the trains were running 6 minutes late. When I asked the station master about it, he shook his head and told me not to worry. He said this happens every couple of years, and I asked him if it was because of the Lincoln Ghost Train, and he just laughed. And we're back with Expanded Perspectives. I love those stories, these phantom train encounters. Very interesting. You know, they hear them sometimes or they see them sometimes. Mm-hmm. And these are happening all over the world. It always reminds me of these, like, it's almost like you're watching a movie. Something is playing itself out in front of these people over and over and over and over. It usually be tied to something tragic that's happened, whether it be a crash or something like that. I mean, I don't know. I just find those stories interesting. And I don't know why, if it's like a, I'm trying to think. Because overall, I'm not huge into like ghosts and things. Mm-hmm. But for some reason, like a phantom train or a phantom ship especially, I don't know why the ships seem
ships
to do it for
especially,
me.
Especially, yeah.
Right? It just seems like those are more interesting.
Yes.
And more, I don't know why, more real.
Well, the always think about every time phantom train, anytime that's ever mentioned, I think of Ghostbusters 2, which is what we were talking about in the intro, but I think of Ghostbusters 2. Remember when Ernie's in there and he gets hit by that train, you know, and it just, it freaks you out because it's the old train line and all that stuff. I mean, I don't know. I think about stuff like that. That's awesome.
You can hear the train from where we live at night.
Yes.
And now I was thinking after I'm doing the segment this week when I was putting it together, I'd hear the train at night. And I was like, man, I wonder if that's real train or if that's a ghost train.
Right? Yeah. There's no way of knowing. Yeah.
Very, very cool.
Hey, I got something. Here's something I'm going to bring up because we had talked about this in your little talk about going to the moon, you know, and us going up there and all this. And you and I have always discussed what's the easiest way to train for living off planet. Would be to train in the ocean. You know, you and I have never understood how come there's not more things like
that. Because when astronauts are training for spacewalks, they have a giant pool, right?
Yes.
You've seen the videos of that.
Well, this comes from MSN.com. You're going to get a kick out of this. China plans to build a massive sea lab, Kyle, about 10,000 foot underwater.
Oh, 10,000 feet underwater.
Underwater.
Wow. Yeah, you know what? It's about time they do that. Of course,
right?
There's going to be people that are going to tell you that there's already secret bases underwater.
Yes, yeah.
And also, like, alien bases, right?
Yes. Well, this is what it says, that they're speeding up their efforts to design and build a manned deep-sea platform to help it hunt for, you ready? Minerals in the South China Sea, man.
Well, it makes sense, right?
And
why
also,
try to spend the money to go off the planet
if we got them
do
here.
It right here?
Yeah. It also says that it may also serve a military purpose in disputed waters. Of course, you know, the China and the U.S. are going back and forth about the sea, but they believe they call it an oceanic space station. And they're saying it would be located in as deep as 9,800 feet or 3,000 meters below the surface. Now, this is according to a recent science ministry presentation viewed by Bloomberg. Now, the project was mentioned in China's current five-year economic plan released in March and ranked number two on a list of the top 100 science and technology priorities. Now, it says here that the authorities recently examined the implementation of the project and decided to accelerate the process, according to the presentation. Now, Brian Clark is a senior fellow at the Washington-based Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, and he says that having this kind of long-term inhabited station has not been attempted this deep, but it is certainly possible. Manned submersibles have gone to those depths for almost 50 years. The challenge is, though, is operating it for months at a time is what they're going to try to do. Now, how wild is that?
That's pretty crazy.
Yeah. And when you talk about that, the problem is it's a shipping lane and that the U.S. has been sending ships of its 7th Fleet. This is to ensure freedom of passage through an area that carries $5.3 trillion of global trade a year.
No, but it's going to be way underwater, so what's the problem?
Yeah. Well, it's just because you're building something just because it's underwater. Like, you know, it would be like me coming over here and digging underneath your house.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, it would be interesting to go down there, right?
Yes.
And if you want to talk about practicing to build a base on the moon or Mars, what better place than to practice than to be underwater, right?
Well, like I've always said, if something was to go wrong and there were survivors, it's a lot easier to get to them.
Yeah, yeah.
You can get to people a lot faster, and you can experiment here. This is one of those things to me that I'm like, instead of experimenting in space, all the money we've wasted to try to, you know, break the Earth's orbit, why don't we just spend that money in the ocean and practice here, not drilling oil, not practice doing all that before we see what we can, you know, pick up and go with there.
Right, and on a space base, or a space base, an underwater base at 10,000 feet, if you looked out a window, if you had one, it would just be black. I'd like to have an underwater base, like only like 100 feet, like in the Caribbean.
Yes.
Where you could see fish, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure.
That would
yes.
be way cooler.
Yeah. Well, and they're also talking about people using it because they may be able to do it to harvest oil instead of having all these offshore platforms, you know, and they got to build them and anchor them to the seafloor and all that, or trying to make some float. So they're, you know, they go against Mother Nature where they can withstand the beatings. If you built it underwater and could figure out a way to make it all run and do all that and then pump up or whatnot, would be way easier than having it built above water.
You know, one of the coolest things I remember as a kid when it comes to underwater?
Oh, underwater. Okay.
Was James Bond. Remember his white car that would turn into a submarine?
Yes.
How cool was that?
yes, dude. Yeah, that was a great one.
That is awesome. Well, we really appreciate everybody being here. If you'd like to hear more, don't forget every Thursday we do another show called Expanded Perspectives Elite. And if you join Elite, it's $5 a month or $55 a year. You get an additional show every Thursday or Friday and access to our entire back catalog. So if you want to sign up, go to the website, expandedperspectives.com. It's pretty simple to do. If you'd like to share a story with us, you can email the show at expandedperspectives@yahoo.com. Or if you'd like to call the show, 817-945-3828. And if you'd like to follow the show on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, whatever, you know the deal. Just search us up. We're easy to find. Cam, you got anything big planned for the week?
I got a lot of work to catch up on from last week. I'm going to be grinding. Yeah, this will be a rough week, you know, and all that stuff. But you know what? Hey, everybody's healthy. Everybody's happy. Everything's going good, man. It's just work. You know what I mean, guys?
Yeah.
Everybody that's listening. I mean, we all got work. It's just work. I mean, just get up in the morning, you smile, like, oh, hell, things could be a little bit worse.
It's better to have worse than to not have any.
Well, and even if that, it's just, you know, you woke up. Let's just get up. Let's just put the grind in. And let's just go after it.
Right? I agree. Well, all you Elite members will speak to you on Thursday. For everybody else, have a good one. I'm Kyle Filson. He's Cam Hale.
Peace.
And we're down, we go, go. Oh, we're down.